This is the worst podcast I've ever been on.
These guys are shit. It's true. It's true.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Our traveling fanboys. Welcome once again, Place to Be Nation listeners, to the longest running weekly
episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. My God, Greg.
That was awful. Yeah. We are the hard traveling fanboys. I'm Greg Phillips. That voice on the other end of the line there is Nick Duke. And we are bringing you something a little bit different for the show. As many longtime listeners may know, on our fifth week episodes, which don't happen that often, but on our fifth episodes, we have in the past done giant size editions where we bring in a world of collaborators to do projects like the Fantasy Comics Draft or the Watchmen LA, which is still in production. This time we're going to start a new kind of recurring feature on the show that is drawing back to our days when we were writing a column for the website. We used to do... Actually, our first stuff that we ever wrote for Place to Be Nation was called Secret Origin, and it was kind of the story of our journey into comics, how Nick and I became comic book fans, how the comic book love kind of bridged our friendship in college. And so we thought we want to go out into the world and interview other interesting people about comics and their journeys into the world of comics. So in this debut episode of the Secret Origin podcast, we have a very special guest, first-time guest here of the show and a Place to Be Nation. He is the WWE SmackDown referee. You see him every Tuesday night on USA Network. WWE official Jason Ayers, and as you're about to hear, he's also a longtime comic book fan. Jason, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Absolutely, our pleasure indeed. And I guess kind of the premise of this show is to find out how you kind of came to fall in love with comics, because I understand that as much as you're passionate about your career, you're also very passionate about comic books.
Yeah, absolutely. So growing up, I've been in a military family. So we met every 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. And when I was a kid, it was one of those things, no matter what school I ended up at or no matter where I ended up in my life, the two things that always followed, I always had something I could connect with somebody on, you know, whether it be first grade, sixth grade, or, you know, even going up into high school, were professional wrestling and comic books. There was always going to be somebody in my class that shared that same, at least one of those, if not both, because there's a lot of crossover between the odds. But, there was always going to be somebody that I could just connect immediately with on that. So, you know, it was one of those things that just kind of followed me throughout my life on up to now even.
Why do you think there is, I was thinking about that today, Nick and I have talked about it in the past on the show, why do you think there is such a crossover between comic book fandom and wrestling fandom?
You know, I've talked about this a lot with both with guys in, you know, in the wrestling sphere and in the comic book sphere. There's a lot, if you think about it, it goes down to it, professional wrestling, sports entertainment, whatever term you want to use for what, you know, what I do in my Clark Kent life, is... Basically, it's a good guy and a bad guy and an issue that they're in conflict over. And comic books, when it boils down to it, it's a good guy and a bad guy and an issue that they're in conflict over. So, I mean, it's kind of almost like comic book superheroes come to life. You know, the tights maybe are a little skimpier and a little less clothing going on. And the combat may be a little more hand-to-hand and a little less, laser beams, but a lot of it's the same, you know, same thing, same storytelling, and same, you know, same kind of tropes to a lot of it.
Awesome.
And you can jump in here if you want to, Nick. I was just going to say, with Nick and I, our love of comics started kind of similarly, but at different ages. Like for me, I remember being 4 years old and walking, and back in those days, it was when you go to the grocery store and you'd find comics still on the newsstand and at the spinner rack. So I remember Superman number 14 by John Byrne when I was 4 years old. I begged my mom to buy this for me because it had Superman on it. And it sort of started my love affair with comics. Nick, you actually, I think, got Spider-Man at Walmart. Is that correct?
Yeah, so right after the first Sam Raimi movie came out, let's see, Ultimate Spider-Man at that point had been going about a year and a half, going on 2 years. And so they had done a repackaged version of the first trade paperback that they had done just for Walmart. And so I was just kind of walking the aisles and picked it up and immediately fell in love and wound up buying that, and then went to Barnes & Noble and picked up like every trade of the series they had. And it was a slippery slope from there. So I guess what we're getting to is, like, is there a book like that that you remember being, you know, your first one?
You know, over the years, there was, you know, one or two here and there that were kind of, when I look back, I don't really remember the specific moment of, you know, of walking in the store and picking it up. Like, Man of Steel 1, when, you know, the 80s was 86, 87, that reboot.
Yep.
I remember picking that one up. I remember specifically picking that one up. But, when I look back through the collection and I see that was in there, I'm like, oh, yeah. So there was, you know, little ones here and there over the years. But when I really first started getting heavily, heavily into collecting and reading and that sort of thing, we were living in Japan at the time. My dad was stationed over there, and you know, obviously, when you're on the military base, it's kind of like little America, and you're kind of beholden to what the base exchange store has as far as toys, as far as games, as far as books and that sort of thing. And they had not maybe a spinner rack worth, but it was, you know, just on a normal shelf of handful of Marvel books and a handful of DC books they just carried every week, you know, and I would assume we were probably a little behind stateside more than likely, but, you know, it's hard to say now. But the X-Men books and the Superman books I picked up religiously, no matter what, you know, every time it came out, I'm begging my mom, hey, can I just, you know, just this one here, just, the, you know, just this time, not, you know, not every time, not just this time. And of course, just this time was every time. but and it was one of those things where, the collector instinct took over and I had to get every week.
Right.
You know, Superman was releasing a new book every week with the little diamond with the...
Yeah, the triangle
chronologically. Diamond, yeah. And, you know, that was around this time also was the Doomsday Saga. So that really hooked me.
Oh, man. Yeah, that was huge.
Yeah, the Doomsday Saga, the Age of Apocalypse hooked me really, really deep. And I've always been a sucker for alternate universe stories, and I don't know what that says about me as a person. But those were kind of the real seminal stories that kind of hooked my interest. And then from there, I was off to the races. You know, I had to read everything I could get my hands on. I'm picking up trades of Dark Phoenix and trades of, you know, the Metro Saga on the X-Men side and, you know, read just everything I could get my hands on.
Yeah, it's interesting how that era of late 80s, early 90s comics was so big. Like, people kind of forget about how big it was. Because I remember I was at elementary school, we would have, like, these arguments at the playground about who would win between these characters or who was going to end up when Strife takes his mask off, what's he going to look like in the X-Men books, you know? Or what was... Well, who was the real Superman during the reign of the Superman storyline, stuff like that. One of the other things of that era, I don't know if you had a chance to get into this stuff, but do you remember the trading card phenomenon of the early 90s with Marvel cards and stuff? Did you ever get into those?
Oh, absolutely. I think I still have them out in the garage.
Yeah.
Because, that was kind of – before I got into comic books, I was a huge baseball card collector. So then as I started reading the books, it was just kind of a natural progression to pick up, you know, all of those sets, the Marvel Masters. Works. I remember I got real heavy into I think it was, didn't Fleer have Flare series or something, a little bit heavier card stock. And it was just, it feels like it was a different time collection wise you know, I don't know that the trading cards would fly as much today.
Mm-mm. No, it was definitely a different time, because, you know, we I guess our generation just wanted to have something to collect. We had comics, we had cards, we had Pogs for a while. you know, so like, it was, those cards were so amazing, because all the playground arguments, we would try to settle them by looking at the back of the Marvel. Well, he's got a 7 energy projection. Oh, yeah, well, Captain America's got a 7 fighting ability. So, you know, who's going to win there? So it's just a fun time as a fan. So kind of as you went to these storylines, you mentioned Death of Superman, Age of Apocalypse. What are some of the stories that have kind of defined your fandom? I'll give you an example from our end. Like Nick and I, we tell the story a lot, but we're huge Geoff Johns fans because we both got into his Green Lantern run pretty long, and it's weirdly sort of forged all these, it made our friendship stronger because we had all of our friends were reading this Green Lantern title at the same time. And so we followed it over the course of what it was, years basically. And that's kind of what we look back as one of our sort of defining comic books. And for Nick, Ultimate Spider-Man would be that as well. What are some of the stories or runs for you that have kind of defined your fandom?
So the one that I always come back to is always Dark Phoenix Saga. That's just my, you know, A1, number one time favorite story, arc, run, whatever you want to call it. Which is why it breaks my heart so bad that the movies have been so terrible every time.
I was about to ask you about
that. Oh, my goodness. We're what, 2 strikes right now?
Yep.
It's unbelievable. I'm praying that Kevin Feige is able to do something with that, please, for the love of God. but no, you know, and not even just Dark Phoenix, but, like, you know, obviously that's the A1, number one. That whole Claremont run, you know, obviously was a little interesting towards the end, but the early Claremont stuff, especially the Claremont Burn stuff, I just absolutely, I could reread that every day. And, you know, and sometimes I do. You know, that's one of my go-tos on the airplane, is just kind of bounce back and reread some of that old Claremont run of X-Men, especially the Dark Phoenix stuff.
What is it about it that sort of stands the test of time? Certainly, I don't know that X-Men has had, I love a lot of the X-Men stories from when I was a kid, Fictions and all that stuff. It was good stuff, but, like, it doesn't feel like it stood the test of the time the way that the Claremont, certainly the Claremont and Byrne era, but really Claremont and all of his collaborators did.
You know, I think what it is he, it feels like he had such a vision of where he wanted to go with everything. And, you know, little moments early would pay off years down the line, and just, you know, the web would weave as time would go on over that entire run of books, and you know, there'd be callbacks to things that happened 100 issues ago, 50 issues ago, or whatever. And, you know, kind of tying that back into my other love being pro wrestling, it's kind of that ecosystem of things that have happened and lore that builds on itself. You know, same kind of thing with characters that have built over 10 years, 20 years, you know, or whatever. I think that's what really gets me, is that years upon years of lore to draw from.
You mentioned, like, you know, getting into comics at an early age and then kind of having to go back and find stuff. You know, I feel like it's kind of spoiled with stuff like Marvel Unlimited or DC Universe. What was that experience like, having to, like, seek things out? Because it used to be a lot more difficult than it is now. And where would you find these things as you bounced around from place to place?
Yeah, you know, I got lucky in that there were just a few. Maybe that's why I keep going back to, you know, Dark Phoenix in that era, because those I was able to find collected trades of,
right.
You know, just paperback, you know, nothing like a hardcover omnibus like you would have on your shelf now, but just, you know, just the basic old trade paperbacks. And, you know, I don't even remember where I found them. I think they had some of them at, you know, the base military base bookstores, and as we got back stateside in later years, you know. But a lot of that kind of thing, so as I'm getting older into high school and started getting more into actually being part of the wrestling community and, you know, getting involved in that as a career, which started that my sophomore year of high school. So as that kind of started to take over as the primary, comics kind of went on the back burner a little bit. So, you know, I missed probably most of the 2000s up into the early 2010s, up until Secret Wars, the Hickman Secret Wars run, that really hooked me back in. And it's, you know, just since, which is what, 4 years ago now, four or five years. It's been just a mad dash of, you know, people talk about, well, this, you know, this run was awesome. Okay, well, Marvel Unlimited, go Gadget iPad, and let's read that one. And, you know, just kind of catching up on all the stuff that I feel like I missed over those years, almost as a disservice to myself, you know, just because of the nature of life.
Yeah, no, that makes plenty of sense. the Nick, I know, is high on that Secret Wars series, so he talks about it all the time as being one of his modern favorite crossover events. So it's cool that it hooked you back in, made you a fan again.
Yeah, you know what's cool about that to me, and I don't know if you feel the same way, it felt like all those side miniseries felt like a love letter to the longtime comic fan.
Yep.
You know, so like the little, you know, 4-issue Extinction Agenda and 4-issue, 4 or 5-issue Civil War redo, and just all of those. It was like, oh man, these were all the things that to me back then, and now I'm reading about a new light with a new set of eyes. It was just really cool, and I think that was just the perfect time, perfect storm of everything to hook me back in, and boy, if I ain't hooked back in now.
Yeah, that was that was probably one of the event series in recent memory, anyway, with some of the best tie-ins, really. And not all of them were like essential to the story, but you felt like you said, like you were getting some sort of fan service out of most of them. Like I remember reading, oh God, I read a lot of them. Old Man Logan was great and wound up, you know, spinning off into its own ongoing series. Spider-Man Renew Your Vows was kind of the same thing, and that one definitely felt like a fan service-y love letter kind of thing, where Dan Slott is saying, okay, if you're one of those people who's hated my run because the marriage isn't here, here's a little bit of, here's just a little bit of fan service for you to kind of tide you over a little bit. So yeah, I definitely love that series as well. It's interesting with that one, I was never a big Fantastic Four fan, and then by the time Secret Wars ended, I was like, I just read a Fantastic Four story, but didn't know it until the very end when you kind of like see the pieces put together. Were you a big FF fan at any point?
You know, I never really was. Kind of same thing, and until Secret Wars, and then it ended, and you know, the Fantastic Four went away into Foxland. And
hi, folks. Todd Weber here, the manager. We had a little bit of audio difficulty here, and we dropped the call for a brief moment. We assume that Jason is talking about the Fox film Fantastic Four and how terrible, how bowling shoe ugly it is, and how it derailed the Fantastic Four for years to come in the eyes of the public.
I rail about it on my Twitter on semi-regular occasion. I just one of the few movies I hold a personal issue with.
We actually, we have not seen it yet. We're actually planning to watch, we're doing a series where we watch worst comic book movies and try to figure out if there was a way to save them. And that's actually the next one we were planning on doing was the Josh Trank Fantastic Four.
Oh, you poor guys. I took my son to see it at the Dollar Theater and I still felt like I got gypped. It was just, okay, let me put it this way. I feel like it would be a good movie, but not necessarily a good Fantastic Four movie.
Yeah. That makes sense.
I understand that.
I mean, I'm somebody that I didn't even think the last, like the first Fantastic Four movie was very good. But I heard from almost everybody that it is significantly better than this one.
Yeah, I didn't hate the first two. You know, even the Surfer movie, they were fun. Exactly, they weren't going to win an Oscar, but they were fun.
Yeah, kind of lighthearted.
This one was not fun.
Yeah, kind of lighthearted and goofy, which captures the. I mean, honestly, kind of the feel of those early Fantastic Four stories that people still look back on so fondly today. You mentioned you have a son. Have you been trying to introduce him to comics at all? How's that process going?
I do actually. I've got one's 11, one's 3. The 3-year-old, you know, he's more into his Disney Princess comic books and you know, that sort of thing. But my 11-year-old, he really is getting into Miles Morales and some of the younger characters, kind of awesome. Some of the champions, you know, the Kamala Khans and younger characters for younger readers, which I think is kind of cool. Right.
Oh yeah, that's absolutely
that's great. I mean, we talked about Nick and I a bunch of times about how comics in the last 15-20 years had, for as much as they'd catered to audiences like us, they had kind of lost the kids' audience a little bit because everything was kind of being written and made for adults. And so I think Miles and Kamala and so many of these young characters that have come up in recent years have reared an audience that has always been there and wanting content, but they just haven't been getting content for so long. So definitely a cool thing that your kids are able to get into comics in sort of a similar way to what you did.
Yeah. It's kind of cool to watch them, you know, and see what they gravitate towards and what about those characters and that sort of thing. You know, we went to see Into the Spider-Verse and that just absolutely, obviously the art style and, you know, the throwback fan service types of things really hooked me. But then at the same time, you know, watching him with with Miles and with Gwen and, you know, those characters. It was very cool to share that moment.
Well, I'm glad that you brought that up, because that was actually what I was going to do next, is talking about outside media, outside of comics. What was your history with that? You know, we've told about how we saw, you know, first saw the 89 Batman movie or whatever it was in our youths that sort of sucked us in. I remember the Christopher Reeve Superman, the first comic book media I remember in my lifetime. But what about you? What outside comic book related media kind of drew you in as a youngster, and what are your favorites now today?
You know, same thing. The 89 Keaton Batman movie was just incredible for its time, especially, you know, it's one of the few that maybe doesn't hold up 100%, but still holds up pretty well. You know, but at the same time, I think for me, I was more of a Saturday morning cartoon kind of guy. Mm-hmm. So X-Men, the animated series, yep, always my go-to. You know, I kind of drifted off a little bit from the Saturday morning cartoons before the Spider-Man animated series. And I feel like wasn't there a Fantastic Four series kind of a lot around that same time?
There was Fantastic Four, Iron Man, Hulk. And I think a really bad Avengers show all around that same time.
Right, yeah. I kind of drifted off by that time, but, you know, X-Men the Animated Series is one that stuck with me even up till now. You know, it's one of those that when I can track it down, I'll throw an episode or two on an airplane on a flight somewhere.
It really was one of the first shows, live action or cartoon, to approach comic books in the same way that comic books did, in terms of telling long-term narrative storytelling that would pay off threads from earlier seasons. You know, the death of Morph in the first episode, and he comes back in the second season and is like the, you know, one of the main bad guys. And, you know, and it's, that was really revolutionary for the time. I've been watching Saturday morning cartoons since I was a kid, and I had never really seen anything like it. And it drew me in from day one. And to this day, I'm still super nostalgic about it. I'm the staunchest defender of the Jim Lee era costumes that you'll find. What about you with that assessment of the show? What was it about the show that kind of makes it stand out?
Yeah, definitely. You know, the long-term payoffs, and, you know, kind of the same sort of thing as the Claremont run with me there, was this, you know, ecosystem of lore that's built up over season upon season upon season. But at the same time, what was cool to me was that if you had read the source material and read the original books, it stayed pretty true to most of what happened in stories that it was adapting. And, you know, I'm pissed when it comes to that sort of thing. Like I want my movies and I want my cartoons and I want my shows to be pretty faithful adaptations of the source material, which is maybe why I hold such a grudge against the Trank Fantabby. But, you know, and that was one of the things that I just absolutely loved about that. It was, oh yeah, no, I've read this story. Okay, cool. Hey, so, you know, buddy in elementary school, so here's where this is going. This is what's getting ready to happen here. Check this out. It's going to be great. You know, and like just being able to puff at that and have those kind of fan service kind of payoffs was awesome to 10-year-old me or whatever I was at that point.
One of the things I always loved about both X-Men the Animated Series and later Batman the Animated Series was, you know, we've talked about it before. We feel like a lot of times kids' programming will kind of talk down to kids or treat them like they're stupid, and I always felt like X-Men the Animated Series and Batman never did that to us. Like it when we were coming up, I felt like it gave us a little credit and depended on us to remember things and callbacks and like you said, kind of track that long form. And so like even watching it as a kid, I just remember feeling like this is a show that is not speaking down to me or you know, patronizing me in any way. And I always appreciated it even as a kid.
Yeah, which I think is one of the things why it holds up so well now, because right, you know, it without that talking down to or patronizing or, you know, the G.I. Joe don't burn your hand on a hot burner stuff, like, which for what it's worth it was great for the time, but, you know, with the kind of you better not, you know, or I'm Captain America and I'm here to save you kitten in a tree or whatever, like without that kind of stuff, with it treating you like a consumer of this media and not just a kid watching Saturday morning cartoons, I think maybe is part of why it holds up so well now. Mm-hmm. For, you know, even the nostalgic adult viewer or, you know, watching it back on Hulu or whatever.
And sometimes when they would have a character deliver that sanctimonious grandstanding speech, Wolverine would walk up and punch him in the gut. So it was kind of nice as a kid to see the flip-flop of what I had grown up seeing on G.I. Joe and He-Man and stuff like that. Definitely. And it influenced shows like Justice League Unlimited years later, which did the same kind of long-form callback storytelling. And really reflects the medium. And you drew the comparison to wrestling, and I think that's a really great one. Talk about long-form storytelling and this ecosystem of lore, because, like, I remember as a kid, like, you if you like something, you're going to remember it, and generally when you're a kid. And so I remember, you know, Bret Hart and the British Bulldog wrestle at In Your House in December 95, and I'm, like, freaking out. And my friends are like, why are you so excited about this random match? I'm like, well, because they wrestled in 92 and the Bulldog beat him. How's Bret gonna get over on him this time? You know, it was it's the similar kind of patterns that I think drive us all together. What do you remember? Were you a fan when Raven would wear, like, the comic book T-shirts out on Nitro? Like, he had a Sandman shirt. That was so cool. Do you remember seeing guys? What is your first recollection of comics influence into pro wrestling?
You know, obviously, I think the one that you kind of go back to a lot is Hurricane Helms.
Mm.
You know, it was the first real superhero, and it was, you know, done kind of for camp and for, you know, a little bit more gimmicky, but like it.
But it was over as hell.
Yeah, right. And, you know, getting to know him now and work with him, you know, in the capacity that we're all in now, he's a legitimate huge comic book fan. So he was drawing on, you know, that's why he has the Green Lantern tattoo.
Green Lantern tattoo.
Yep. On his shoulder. You know, so it was done kind of as more of a nod back, or, you know, stuff like Rey Mysterio always has something different variation of his gear, especially for the WrestleManias. He always seems to draw on a superhero or, you know, from a comic book character or a movie. Or whatever. I think that was kind of the earliest type of thing. And then, you know, as I started getting into the company after I got hired as a ref in 12, you kind of start to realize that, man, a lot of these guys are just kind of closet nerds like me that, you know, grew up on the same stuff. And it just kind of, you know, draws us all together. Like, you know, I can roll in and, you know, from the props and carps guys to the video guys to the backstage workers to the producers to the wrestlers, and hey, did you read that new House of X, or hey, did you check out Absolute Carnage, or, you know, whatever's dropping. Like, those are the kind of conversations that I'll spend 15-20 minutes just sitting on a road case when I probably should be doing something else. You know, like that's kind of what I spend my days doing.
So who are some of your favorite guys to rap with about this kind of stuff?
You know, so on the roster, I know Cedric Alexander is a big comic book fan. He and I talk a little bit. Mike Rome, the Raw ring announcer, is a gigantic comic book fan, actually, to the point that he and I have talked about some ideas we have for a couple of things. But honestly, a lot of it are the people you wouldn't know.
Right.
Like I said, you know, like some of the guys that work backstage is one of the props, stage carps guys. His name, he and I will talk comic books, current and old school, and, you know, for just hours if we got the time to do it. You know, just you find people perk up when you're talking with somebody about whatever, whether it be old stuff or new stuff or, you know, whatever's going on. And, oh yeah, no, what, I read that, what do you think about this, or, you know, whatever character they like. Oh, you're a fan too. Oh, that's kind of cool. Okay, well, we'll double back to that, you know. But it's more of the roster than not, I think, at this point, at least having passing interest.
What is it right now that is kind of, that most people are talking about? Is it House of X? Because that seems to be the topic du jour on the internet. Is it the same way for you guys backstage?
It is with me, just because that's what I'm tracking people down to. Hey, okay, so on this, like, you know, because Hickman book, like, I want to hear everybody's takes on things and kind of, you know, okay, how did you interpret this and where do you think this is going, kind of thing. That's kind of the big one right now. You know, there's a few guys that I'll talk old school stuff with, because right now, like, so my big thing when I'm on the road is I like to go to local comic shops or you know, just find in whatever town I'm in, find the local comic shop and let's go back issue digging. You know, so I trying to fill out the Claremont runs and, you know, finishing out an X Factor run and a New Mutants run and, you know, those 90s X books, just because there's a finite number to them. So it kind of focuses my digging a little bit. You know, that's kind of a lot of what I'll talk to a lot of guys about, you know, some of those older school 90s stuff that we grew up on.
That was going to be a question I was going to have, is like, you know, being on the road so much, how do you maintain the fandom? Is it going to the places and the cities that you're in, or do you kind of have a home base when you get back from the road where you're picking your stuff up?
Yeah, no, I do have my home base here in Orlando, a shop called Epic Comics down south of town. That always pulls my stuff. And that's the nice thing about the schedule we're on right now. So SmackDown's on a Tuesday. That means I'm flying home on a Wednesday. So by the time I get on the ground, my route from the airport just happens to take me by Epic Comics. It's a dang thing. So I can pick up my Wednesday books. But yeah, you know, and that, so it doesn't really make sense for me to do much hunting for new stuff when I'm on the road, because I'm getting that taken care of when I get back home. So it's, you know, it's digging for older back issues and just, you know, okay, let's, what do you got here? What, you know, what can I find here that I'm not going to find elsewhere?
What's your favorite discovery that you've made back? Has there been any random ones or weird ones or one that stood out as like, I can't believe I found this?
Yeah. So we were in one of the Dakotas. I can't remember if it was North Dakota or South Dakota. And you know, we met with the ring build. So we finished the ring build and it's maybe, I don't know, noonish lunchtime, give or take. And a bunch of us went to go grab some lunch, and on the walk back from wherever we went, whatever restaurant it was, there was this gigantic two-story thrift store. Not really thrift store, more like a pawn shop like you would see on, you know, Corpon or Pawn Stars, or, you know, it looks like it's more of a Hollywoodish type of thing in Bismarck, North Dakota, or wherever we were. And I'm digging around, just kind of walking around the store, and they had like a china cabinet with a shelf there, and there was four or five just, you know, floppies sitting there. And I, okay, let me check this out. And they had X Factor 5 and X Factor 6, both, you know, both the cameo Apocalypse and the full Apocalypse first appearances for like $3.
No way.
So, yeah. Awesome. So, that's the thing. Like, you go to some of these thrift stores or pawn stores or whatever, and they don't know what they have. It's just, comic books. All right. Nah, $2, whatever. Like, that's what gets me.
Yeah, dude, I miss that. I used to go. When I was in high school and early college, we used to have a lot of – I come from Mobile, Alabama, and there's several, you know, thrift stores and flea markets around town. I used to love going to these flea markets and just digging through their comic book collections and finding and stuff. That's where I found a copy of my very first comic book, Superman number 14. And so, you know, it's just amazing. But that's insane, man. That was an insane book. But that's part of the joy of it, right? That's the part of the joy of going to these comic book shops.
That's it, man. And, you know, and the problem nowadays with the proliferation of comic book fandom, thanks to, you know, Marvel Cinematic and all the success of all the movies and success in all the other media and the awareness that that's brought about of the comic fan, is people know what they got now. You know, it's a lot harder to find those kind of deals and, you know, those diamond in the rough kinds of things.
Well, let's talk about creators for a moment. Who are your all-time favorite comic book creators? You mentioned Chris Claremont already. You mentioned John Hickman. Any other names that pop in mind, either writers or artists?
Yeah, you know, so Charles Soule's stuff I've always kind of dug. And I've kind of gotten to know him a little bit through social media. And, you know, I brought him to one of our shows one time. So, you know, his Daredevil run was awesome. One of my favorites. Snyder and Capullo's Batman run.
Oh, yeah.
Incredible.
So good. So good.
You know, it's another one of those that I'm like, okay, I have to pick up all the trades, keep them on my iPad. And when I, you know, run out of stuff to read, I'll go back and I'll reread those. Tom King stuff also, Mr. Miracle and Vision and all, you know, those kind of world warping types of stories, you know, and maybe that kind of goes back to, you know, what I said earlier about I'm a sucker for an alternate universe. I'm a sucker for just kind of having my mind messed with by a comic, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, the it's in, oh, go ahead, Nick. Sorry.
No, you're fine.
I was just gonna say the Snyder Capullo Batman. Actually, just the last comic book I read was actually the first of their new Last Night on Earth that is coming out in sort of a prestige format. Really, really good, and real. You want to talk about mind warping?
Yeah,
it is. I'm still not sure I know what happened, but I know it was awesome. So, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I was gonna say you mentioned throwing stuff on your iPad constantly or pulling up Marvel Unlimited when you're or what have you. But you're still picking up print stuff. So how do you feel about the kind of still, I don't know if people are fully embracing the digital transition yet or not, or what are your thoughts on in terms of the readership?
You know, so for me, I'm kind of somewhere in the middle. I love the feel of having a physical copy in my hand, but at the same time, it's tough to throw, you know, four or five trades in a backpack and lug it around on a, you know, 4-day. So when I'm just for stuff to read, generally speaking, I'm reading it on my iPad. I'm reading, you know, whether it be, you know, whatever I picked up that week, I'm going to immediately pop the codes into my Marvel account and read them on Comixology, and throw the books in a long box and just kind of let them sit there. But, you know, when it comes to collecting runs and stuff, I think it's more almost like an oversized baseball card, you know, like of just I get them all. Mm-hmm. But as far as, you know, I see a lot more still physical readers, you know, of mm-hmm. guys in the locker room that are picking up stuff. They still like to read the physical media. There's just something to wrapping mm-hmm. a book and having the feel of the page in your hand. And I don't know, there's just something, I don't know if it's nostalgic or mm-hmm. what it is, but
even the ability, I think, to sort of glance from page to page while you're holding the book spread open, you know, it's something that's difficult to replicate. That ability, you know, this classic, I think about some early 90s comics, you know, Death of Superman with the giant two-page spreads. It's kind of hard to get across that level of grandeur when you're not holding it in your hand, even though I read digitally as well. Especially for a lot of our retro stuff that we read. I'll look through Marvel Unlimited or DC Universe, but there's something just about the grandness, I think, of the art sometimes when you hold the book in your hands.
For sure, and it, you know, really hammers home that, especially like you know, back to creators, Alex, obviously, you know, one of my, I'm not gonna say a life goal, but something that I really want to at some point is to own an Alex Ross original to hang on my wall. Whether that ever happens, we'll see. But you know, it's one of those things when an Alex Ross book with the cover, it just hammers home, wow, somebody actually did, this is a real piece of artwork that mm-hmm. somebody did by hand and poured their heart and their soul into. It doesn't necessarily come across when you're just looking at it on a screen.
I certainly not an original, but I still have I still have, when Alex Ross did a line of posters for Marvel's 75th anniversary, the Thor one that he did, I went out and bought immediately and framed. Still hanging on my wall. I mean, it's one of the most beautiful. Yeah, I can feel you on the Alex Ross art. You mentioned you've been with the company since 2012, kind of got back into comics in 2015. As you're traveling throughout the country, what are some of your favorite shop city when you know, hey, I'm going to a certain city, this shop is awesome, I got to stop by here because I might be able to find something good?
Yeah, so there's a shop in Lafayette, Louisiana, and I know he's going to kill me. I can't remember the name of the shop, but my guy Jeff LeJuni runs in Lafayette, Louisiana. I always make it a point to stop by, visit him, a friend to all of us, you know, on not just in the company, but even just on the referee side of things. And you know, he always does right by us, and great store, great service, great selection. But you know, beyond that, obviously there's the Midtowns and you know, and the Mile Highs and you know the big famous stores. There's not really anything that's jumped out at me as far as a local shop that I'm like, oh man, I have to go by here. You know, aside from my man Jeff in Lafayette.
Shout out to Jeff in Lafayette. We'll have to check that out if we're in the area. That's not terribly far from my old stomping ground, so I have to check that out someday. But one of the things that we run into, I think all of us run into eventually, if you've collected comics for a long time, space issues. How do you deal with the space issues on just storing all this stuff?
You know, I actually, in my closet, I keep all of my long boxes, or long short boxes, actually, to just about the bottom of my shirts. So it's pretty much taking up every square inch of space I have in my closet, and I'm kind of, you know, maneuvering around to get to stuff and moving boxes around to get to the one I need to. Luckily, space issue has not become an issue as of yet. But man, I'm sure if I keep traveling, it's going to be
the day we'll get there.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, let's kind of circle back to outside media. I want to kind of just ask you a few, you know, standard questions, ask guests and things of that nature when we'd have them on other shows. What is your favorite comic book movie?
Favorite comic book movie. You know, I that always seems to change whenever there's a new release, and it kind of over. as of right now, you know, Into the Spider-Verse, I still is absolutely up there. You know, I know obviously Endgame and the grandeur and the scale of both Endgame and, you know, Infinity War taken as a two-piece set are incredible. And I'm firmly in the camp of Robert Downey Jr. for an Oscar.
Oh, but 100%. We were saying that the week, like 2 days after the movie when we saw it, we were talking about this dude deserves, he won't get one, but he deserves one.
Yeah, maybe we can give him like a comic book Oscar or something. Into the Spider-Verse was awesome from a, not just a fan service standpoint, but just the art felt like you were watching a comic come to life. And to me, that really kind of resonates, you know, with the longtime fandom, you know, going back to the 90s and, you know, kind of the origins of, even before that, the origins of Spider-Man with, you know, the Ditko artwork and kind of some of the visual things he would do, you know, kind of resonated through in that movie a little bit, I think.
You talk about love letters. That movie, to me, felt like a love letter to all eras of Spider-Man, but it was revolutionary. I remember when the trailer originally dropped, I was like, I don't know about this art style, you know. I just don't know. I mean, I'm glad Miles is getting a movie, but I didn't light my world on fire. Then I saw the movie, and I was like, what was I thinking? It took me about 5 minutes to adjust to the art style, and then when I did, I was like, this is the future. This is a level of ahead of the curve that I hadn't seen since probably like The Incredibles many, many years ago. It was so good. And I'm assuming that's something that's kind of fun to watch with the whole team.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. No, you know, like I said, when I went to see that in the theater, I took my 11-year-old with me. My 3-year-old's not quite there for, going for a theater going experience, but he's discovered it now that it's on Netflix, and absolutely, he loves it as well. You know, he wants to watch the Spider-Man movie with me. And, you know, that's another thing with the Asian game that came out a year ago now, give or take.
Oh, my God.
you want to talk a love letter to the Spider-Man fandom. You know, with all the alternate costumes and throwbacks and callbacks and things in there. But it's so funny when I play that in, you know, if I play it in the living room as opposed to taking it on the road with me, and my youngest is there with me, he will not let me use any costume other than the classic Spider-Man costume. If I try to throw the Iron Spider, or, you know, the Armored Spider-Man or something, you know, one of those wacky or whatever, he's like, no, that's not Spider-Man. I want the Spider-Man costume.
That's awesome. Sometimes the classic suits are classics for a reason. It's amazing how some of those, the 50s and 60s stood the test of time. I made this comment to my buddy Russell Sellers recently about the Flash costume, that they pretty much got it right with the Barry Allen Flash costume. And there's, every time they've tried to modify it, it's kind of had, you know, eventually they just go back to the way it was, with a few little tinkerings here and there. And the same way with Spider-Man's got so many great costumes, but that one just stands the test of time, no doubt. What I loved about, one of the things I love about Spider-Verse is it did kind of what Geoff Johns did in his Green, which is find a way to serve every fan, no matter who your favorite character was. So with Green Lantern, if you were a Hal Jordan fan or a Kyle Rayner fan or a Guy Gardner fan or John Stewart, he found ways to serve every segment of fandom and show you that all of them had value. Spider-Verse could have just been a Miles Morales movie, and it would have been great. But instead, they also found a way to say, hey, here's Peter Parker, and he's great too. And here's this sort of older, schlubby Peter Parker, and he's good too. And, you know, finding a way to serve all these different audiences, it's really just an incredible thing. And you see that in some of the great comic book runs as well. Were there any comics that you're reminded of when you're watching Into the Spider-Verse? Does it remind you in particular of a run or a comic in terms of its of all these different audiences?
You know, that's another thing I feel like that X-Men ultimately does relatively well with in, mm-hmm. you know, bringing, you know, characters from the 90s or from the 80s or even before that, you know, can pop back in nowadays and just dive right back in, you know, resurgence of Wolfsbane in the you know, the just prior to Hickman run, you know, obviously tagged well, but you know, some of the New Mutants characters kind of popping back into things. It was, you know, one of those throwbacks of, hey, you know, these characters still have value. There's still something to this, you know, and I don't know if that was maybe setting up unintentionally or intentionally as the case. I know they've announced the New Mutants book coming, spinning out of House of X, Powers of X, you know, and some of that sort of thing. But, you know, just the random reappearances of characters. It's like, oh yeah, no, that was my, you know, in 95 or whatever the case may be.
Right. Right. They, I'm waiting for them to bring back, Boomer and, Rusty and Skeets or Skids. Rather.
Skids. Yeah.
Yeah. Those were my Young Mutants when I was a kid. Your game, that was going to be another question. Is that your favorite comic book video game, or do you have another one?
You know, it's got to be up there. And, you know, we'll see if it stands the test of time. I feel like it probably will. But, you know, obviously the Arkham series was incredible for its time. But, yeah, I feel like X-Men Legends, you know, and Ultimate Alliance, that whole era of games.
that defined my college years.
Yep.
Oh, man. I think Ultimate Alliance 2 may still be the last game I actually did a midnight and stood in line and waited with the with the line wrapped around the block, which isn't really happening for physical media anymore.
But. No, not so much. We had the all-night sessions with all the Ultimate Alliance games and the X-Men Legends games. It's ridiculous.
It was another one of those, you talk about fan service, that would have four alternate costumes for each character, and each one of them you could pinpoint, oh wait, that's from this mm-hmm. this character in this run. And you know, that's one of the things I feel like kind of dropped the ball in Ultimate Alliance 3, mm-hmm. Which, don't get me wrong, great game, and I really enjoy it, but the costumes are just, they feel like just pops instead of actual callbacks to anything, which is really disappointing.
Yeah, And I'm kind of the opposite of your son in terms of, I was that kid that was always wanting the alternate costumes just because they were different. So that's kind of what one of the things I enjoyed about the Ultimate Alliance games is that ability to sort of, you know, you want to play the brown and tan Wolverine costume or Weapon X costume or the Venom but the symbiote costume for Spider-Man, abilities which would make them feel special. What about the arcade games? Did you ever play any of the classic X-Men arcade game or the Punisher or Avengers or any of those?
Yeah, I did. I played the absolute hell out of the X-Men arcade game.
Oh, so good.
The others, I never really, you know, and again, going back and stuck on a military base, not stuck, but, you know, living on a military base, you're kind of beholden to what happened to be at the bowling alley or the movie theater. And they always seem to have WrestleFest and X-Men the arcade game, where they took pretty much all of my elementary years.
Yes, and all of your elementary quarters.
And that too, yeah.
Yeah, those in the Simpsons game were like at every arcade when I was a kid, and I'm on the rare occasions I find an arcade now, I never find WrestleFest at any of them, and it kills me. I do find X-Men on occasion. I'm so weird in this because I may be the biggest fan in the world of the Punisher arcade game from the 90s, where Nick Fury is inexplicably the Punisher's partner, and it's a like fight, but with the Punisher. So those were fun games. We actually got you to send in a list for our MCU show, where we were kind of putting together a countdown of the MCU movies, the official rankings of all the movies. And while we got you on here, I'm going to ask you kind of your overall view of the MCU. What are your favorites from the MCU, and where do you see it going from here? What are you excited about moving forward?
Yeah, so You know, it's like I mentioned earlier, it's one of those things where pretty much, to me at least, and maybe it's just the fanboy in me, but every movie has been pretty note perfect as far as really capturing the essence of the characters. You know, even the ones that were about going in, just like, you know, everybody else, obviously Guardians of the Galaxy, I wasn't super familiar with the source material, and obviously there was some changes made to fit the movie, but you know, you come out of like, oh, okay, no, that was pretty dead on to what I expect that to have been in hindsight, you know. Or Black Panther, I still think, you know, versions of telling me that whole lore of the character and the entire, you know, kind of getting a full picture of who he is and where he comes from and what his world's like, and, you know, supporting characters and side view, and now you have this whole other world that you can delve into at any given point of Wakanda, you know. And as far as where it's going in the future, man, I, you know, watching those San Diego Comic-Con reveals come through, you know, obviously on Twitter, because I don't get to go to San Diego Comic-Con.
Right.
watching those come through on Twitter is one of those, something new would come across, be like, oh man, I can't wait for that. Oh wait, that's even better. Oh man, that's even better. Oh my God, Blade's back. You know, but like, I feel like each of them kind of has something cool and something different to offer. You know, Loki, I think I'm really excited about that one, because it feels like, just from what I'm reading, that it's almost like Loki, but Quantum Leap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little bit of, yeah.
You know, that intrigues me. And I'm curious to see with WandaVision, and obviously the artwork that's dropping on that, with kind of the idyllic 50s theme, you know, if that pulls maybe some themes from the Tom King Vision run, or, you know, if any of that's in there, I don't know.
Bringing in Wanda's advanced power with reality, right, working potentially. So
exactly, especially going into with her being announced for the new Doctor Strange and the multiverse. I think that kind of thing really, you know, especially with the multiverse aspect added in there, is that how we get Fantastic Four? Is that how we get, you know, mutants into the Marvel Cinematic Universe? I feel like there's so many new directions they can go with things. It's a really cool time to be a fan.
At this point, could Marvel pretty much make a movie about the most absurd? You would have faith that it would work.
You know, I'm looking forward to the Eternals, if that tells you anything. yes. Yeah. Yeah, I think Feige at this point just has the Midas touch that no matter what he gets his hands on, it'll turn to gold. If you're listening, Sony.
We, you know, you mentioned all the announcements coming across at San Diego Comic-Con. We're getting ready for the launch of Disney Plus, which is going to have so many. We're in an era where we're getting 3-4 MCU movies a year. DC is cranking out stuff on the CW. Greg and I talk about all the time, we feel so overwhelmed. Where, like, when we were kids, one or two comic book shows, and you better watch them, because if they, you know, got poor ratings,
even if they sucked, you're there was watch.
You were afraid you were not going to get anything else. Now there's so much, it's almost impossible to keep up. And with you being on the road all the time, how do you pick and choose, and how do you keep up with this, like, constant deluge of comic book content?
And it's weird, the ones that I would have the easiest access to watch on an airplane or whatever, the Netflix series that you can download for an offline watch, are the ones that I'm the most behind on. You know, because when it comes to the movies, become a thing that when there's a new movie at maybe not necessarily the midnight release, but that, you know, 7 o'clock in the evening, the night before pre-midnight release, my oldest and I are going to go and I'm going to dress up, and we're, you know, that's just our thing. So, you know, I always seem to catch the movies as they come out, but the series, man, it's hard to keep up. And I don't know. So we'll see how Disney Plus works. Obviously, I'm going to be a day one subscriber, especially with a 3-year-old Disney Princess fan in the house. You know, I'm very curious to see how that platform works with regards to, you know, saving, downloading things to be able to watch offline, and, you know, in situations where you don't have a connection to keep up with things. Because, again, that's the time when I'm, you know, sitting on a plane for 3 or 4 hours headed to, you know, Wichita or Walla Walla, Washington, or wherever we happen to be on any given day, that I actually have time to catch up on any, you know, or sitting in a hotel room far flung town.
I guess that sort of also makes sense of why comics and wrestling have such a crossover, is you do have a lot of travel, so that's a lot of time to read.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know how I still managed to be backlogged. but
it's incredible the amount of content that we have. We live in really the content era. There's so much content to try to keep up with if you're a fan of these things. Especially being a comics and wrestling fan, there's just so much out to try to keep up with. It's inevitable that you get behind. Thank God for DVR. Thank God for these digital reading services.
Yeah, for sure. It feels like that's kind of becoming a thing, not necessarily just something, but almost across the board. There's just such a deluge of content that you have to pick and choose, or you're just going to be overwhelmed.
Oh, totally. And we're still discovering gems that we've passed over the years to keep up with the ones that we were kind of focused on about our favorite characters. We just read Garth Ennis's The Boys, which inspired them Prime, and really enjoyed that. And that's a series that when it was coming out, I just flat out said, I can't read it. I'm buying like four Batman books and a Green Lantern book every month. You know, it's hard to pick up.
I think, Greg, we would be remiss, you know, in this interview if we did not ask, since he is, you know, such a massive fan of both comics and wrestling, what about wrestling comics? What do we have any of those that stick out in your mind? What are your experiences with the wild and wacky worlds comic books?
Man, I religiously bought the WCW comic in 92, 93, whatever that was, and I still have them. I pulled them out maybe a month or two ago. I just moved back from Indiana back down to Orlando to do some work down at NXT, but. I pulled those out in the move and just kind of read through them a little bit. I'm like, God, these were garbage, but they were so good, but so bad. What happened, you know? I do read some of the stuff we put out with Boom.
Mm-hmm. We read.
You know, I've read
some
a few
of
those. Yeah, and it was kind of welcome surprise. My son, my oldest, that's another one of the things he started wanting to pick up because. He went to WrestleMania in New York with one of our good friends, and they had such a good time that now he's gotten just completely all in on wrestling.
Okay,
and his wrestling fandom has kind of overtaken a little bit. So now when I go to my comic shop, he's like, "Dad, can I pick up the new WWE comic?" And he picked up one the other day that I actually posted about it. I can't remember if it was on Instagram or Twitter or what. Was there was only a special issue from this past year, so it probably came out April, May, somewhere around in there. And it was two or three stories. One of them, and I don't remember who the creative team was, but was kind of recapping Charlotte and Asuka maybe. And one of the shots in there was based on the WrestleMania match from New Orleans last year, which was the match that I refereed at New Orleans WrestleMania last year. So the panels was, Asuka's face on the one side, Charlotte's face on the other side, and then a comic book version of me holding up the SmackDown.
Oh, how cool.
Style.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So technically speaking, I think I'm Marvel canon at this point.
God, amazing. That's fantastic. Well, being that you are Marvel canon now, one day I'm going to have to get you to explain to me the Ultimate Warrior comic. One of the most bizarre things I've ever
read
in all my days.
I don't know what happened there.
I also had The Rock number one,
yeah,
which featured The Rock delivering the rock bottom onto a craps table. Okay. So there were a lot of fun adventures in these random, terrible, and yet terribly awesome wrestling comics. Of course, the WCW comic gave a Cactus Jack and his nefarious plot to attack Sting. There was never a limit what could be done with these. One really good I've read, Nick still hasn't read it yet, is Headlocked. I don't know if you've had a chance to read that one. It was pretty good.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's Michael Kingston's books, right?
That's right, correct.
Yeah, he's actually a pretty good friend of mine. But yeah, the books are incredible. Actually, read the first three trades and then immediately jumped on the Kickstarter for the fourth.
Oh yeah, I was a Kickstarter supporter as well. I was blown away by what he was doing. Really,
so good. And it's really cool that people in the are helping write some of those sub stories. That's kind of gives it an element of realism that you don't get in a lot of the other books.
Well, one thing that as fans, I think all is you think about, what if I got a chance to write a comic? Without giving away anything, if that is in the plans, is that something you've thought about? And if so, is there a character that you really would like to write one day?
It's something that I've always kind of kicked around as an idea, as maybe a when my wrestling days are done, as somewhat of a plan here in 40, 50, 60, 70 years or whatever it may be. And as far as, a specific character, honestly, I haven't really that far ahead. Obviously, as as we've talked at length, much of an X-Men fan as I am, I wouldn't, hate the opportunity to tackle maybe not necessarily the mainline team, because I, don't overestimate my own self-importance, but, maybe a side book or, something along those lines. I think that would be a bucket list moment. I know there's been some precedent for that. There's been a couple of Marvel books that have been written by, I remember Raven did a side story in Spider-Man, I want to say.
About Crusher Hogan. Yeah, about Crusher Hogan, right?
Yeah, right. And that kind of thing. I think
Punk
Drax was
Punk. And he also did a short story in Strange Sports Stories for, I think, a Vertigo book that DC put out a while back that was, I think his was like a baseball focused story of some sort, but I can't remember. I remember I picked up the issue, but it obviously didn't leave that much of an impression on me.
What about your favorite? I mean, that's something that kind of goes across fandom. Some people have obscure picks. Some people are basic like me and just go with Wolverine. But who is your favorite X-Men?
I always kind of grew up
in
my younger years.
My second favorite X-Men.
Yeah, and I don't know what it is about it. He was just so cool. Especially in the 90s, just so cool.
It was the jacket. I think the jacket was so cool.
And then kind of in the more gravitating towards, like you said, some of the more obscure characters, Glob in Age of X-Men was so much fun, just some of that kind of. But yeah, I mean, it just kind of, you always kind of end up coming back to your first love and Gambit's still kicking around.
Yeah, I was the quintessential 90s kid. Wolverine and Gambit and Cable, any of the anti-hero X-Men, I was a big fan of. Team Domino was awesome. Always
loved
her.
So many pouches.
Pouches and leather and guns that looked like they would weigh 7,000 pounds to even carry them around. Some characters would have 8 of them.
Hooked from a thin leather strap.
Yeah. The calf muscles that were enormous with the really tiny ankles
and no feet
at all. Just a great time to be alive and to be a comic book fan. I asked you about the MCU on the Fox X-Men series. I know you mentioned earlier they've been disasters with the Dark Phoenix. Were there any that were good? Did you like Logan, for instance?
The first X-Men movie, I think, obviously was a really seminal moment for comic book fandom in other media, because it was kind of almost the pre-MCU. A lot of black leather that I wasn't really a fan of, but just showing that these characters, you can put them on the big screen and it's gonna sell. There's a market for it. I feel like First Class and Days of Future Past did at least some sort of justice. And then, kind of dropped off with Apocalypse and Dark Phoenix, but they always seem to start strong with the first movie or two, and then just by the time they decide they're going to start going Dark Phoenix for some reason, it just falls off, and it hurts my heart.
We did a recent comparison, actually, between the Dark Phoenix movie and the X-Men 3 The Last Stand. And it's amazing how they both missed the mark in completely. Dark Phoenix 6 is this long, kind of boring, drawn out, you know, uninteresting movie. Last Stand has a ton of stuff happening, some of which is good, but it's condensed into what feels like a 20-minute movie where everything goes by so quickly. So maybe there's a happy medium there for someday, Kevin Feige, whoever it may be, to sort of make this story work on the big screen.
You know, and there's so much that can be done there if you just realistically just stay to the source material.
Mm-hmm.
At three, you know, the story is so, I'm not going to say perfect, but it's such a seminal, iconic story that it feels like it would be hard to screw up, and somehow they managed to twice.
It feels like they always want to skip steps. Like, yeah, they want to skip the space stuff, or they want to skip the Hellfire Club in particular, and really can't skip anything to make the story feel as big and as important as it should. Before we let you off here, I did want to ask you a wrestling question as well about your wrestling fandom. I asked you about your first comic book. What are your first wrestling memories?
So this one I can answer easily. Is around that same time. We were in Japan, in 1991. Just past SummerSlam 1991, Bret Hart had just won the Intercontinental title, and we had hadn't quite moved into the on-base housing we were going to be living in. We just moved overseas. So, you know, school's out, I'm step late, and I'm flipping around the channels, and I happen to catch Primetime Wrestling. And I can remember it plain as day in my mind. And maybe I'm the only guy in the history of a wrestling fan because of Jameson the Nerd.
Oh my God!
But I'm flipping the channels, and there's this just, you know, overblown nerd character with a sock hanging out of his jacket and horn rimmed glasses with the tape in the middle, being berated by Bobby the Brain Heenan. Or no, I'm sorry, it wasn't Bobby Heenan. It was IRS. You know, berating him and chases him off screen and drags him back into the frame. And as he drags him back into the frame, Bret Hart's on the other end of the guy. And then these two guys put down the Nerd and then start brawling over top of the Nerd. And I'm like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen.
I wonder how Bret feels about the fact that not one of his classic matches, but that segment made you a wrestling fan.
You know, and then obviously, you know, from there, same thing as with comic books, you start digging in and start, you know, going down to Blockbuster and getting the 2-tape WrestleMania 4 or the amazing viewers, and, you know, had to watch everything there was to watch. But,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's the one that hooked me, man.
That's fantastic. Those shows were so fun. Like, every time I watch Primetime on the network now, first of all, Bobby Heenan was such a genius. It's ridiculous. But just the fun and the whimsy, amazing what would strike you and what you remember as a kid. You know, one of the banter between Gorilla and Bobby, and how you can see Gorilla trying not to crack as Bobby is delivering these vicious one-liners. What a fun time. Well, thanks for sharing that story. And before we sort of start wrapping up, do you have any comic book recommendations for people? Are there any runs that you think kind of got underrated over the years or anything of that nature that you think people should check out either on Marvel Unlimited or at a comic shop or wherever they might be able to go?
Yeah, you know, so you talk about fun and whimsy and recent stuff that's been on my pull list. Issue 1, Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man, mm-hmm. is just such a fun read, you know. And I got the chance to meet Tom Taylor at MegaCon here in Orlando, and just the nicest guy in the world, you know, like fun loving, kind of jovial sort of dude. And you kind of see that come through in the book. At the same time, they're not afraid to tackle some pretty heavy issues. Like there was issue 5 or 6 or whatever. That was the childhood cancer issue.
Mm.
But like just the series from issue 1 up till now, even, it's such a fun run, and I feel like people are kind of sleeping on that a little bit.
Well, and I feel like part of that is probably because, like, when I hear Tom Taylor, I think I naturally think about Injustice, mm-hmm. or I think about some of his, you know, he's kind of gotten this reputation for writing these very dark stories, or great stories, but dark stories. So to hear him doing this kind of fun, lighthearted Spider-Man is really a testament to him and his versatility as a writer.
Yeah, for sure. And you know what was cool about it for me, at least especially from the first issue that really hooked me, was it leaned hard on the neighborhood aspect than on the Spider-Man aspect. Mm-hmm. You know, it kind of showed Spider-Man and Peter's impact on the world around him and on the people that he meets in his everyday life, and you know, the bum on the kid walking home from school, and the, you know, the mom coming home from work, like, and how Spider-Man being Spider-Man impacts their everyday lives, almost in the same kind of vein as Marvel's, if not necessarily so heavy-handed with it.
That's amazing. That's right up our alley, I think, both our tastes in comics, and it kind of reminds me of one of my favorite stories of all time is actually right after the death of Superman, the Funeral for a Friend and World Without a Superman era, Louise Simonson in particular, one of my favorite issues of all time, where, you know, you see the grieving around the city. You see Lois going and visiting Clark's parents, or rather they go to visit her to help her because she's just trying to hold it together and she loses it. And just seeing how these heroes impact the everyday, you know, Bibbo the Borrower and people like how the everyday people are affected by the heroes oftentimes can be more interesting to me than the heroes themselves or what they're doing. So that's awesome to hear. I'll have to check that run out.
Yeah, for sure. And I feel like those, you know, the friend and those books coming right off of that massive world shattering, mega event of the death of Superman, I feel like those kind of got slept on a little bit more than they should have.
Agreed.
Because, you know, like you said, it really wasn't, it was not necessarily fun's the right word, but, you know, it was a different take. You know, it was Superman books without Superman, and it almost felt like people were looking at it like, okay, all right, let's hurry up and get the guy with the S back. But, you know, if you go back and you read them now, it's different. You know, it's a different kind of take on things, like you said.
Yeah, and really great and patient storytelling as well. Sort of giving us a little, we'd just gone through this big action set piece of, I think Nick described it to me one time as essentially one giant action scene for five issues. But and then you go and you have this sort of, no pun intended, dead period where you're kind of grieving with the character. So it's definitely a cool approach. Well, Jason, tell the people how they can find you on social media for more comics talk, more wrestling talk, etc.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I kind of pride myself on being one of the more accessible guys on social media, which is actually you know, how we started talking, obviously, in the first place. But Twitter, Instagram, Jason Ayer, spelled AYERS. I'm on Twitter. I'm the guy with the blue check. But, you know, I love to talk comics, love to talk wrestling, just love to... Look, man, I'm on there more than I care to admit. So feel free to bother me.
Yeah, it's interesting. Right now, if you go to his Twitter account, folks, he is wanting to talk House of X. So if you've read House of X and you're ready to talk about some of the crazy stuff that Jonathan Hickman's got going on over there, hell to it, man. You'll find some interesting theories out there on the web. I'm sure Jason would love to chat it up about that, right?
Yeah, and especially, you know, by the time this podcast drops, I'm sure enough time will have passed so we can talk about that crazy spoiler in House of X2 that I don't want to say anything about in case people haven't read it, but oh my God, what a twist. Like, hit me up. Let's talk.
Fantastic. Jason, thank you so much
for
joining us. I mean, this is awesome. And we'd love to have you back on again.
I'd love to come back, man. Thanks for having me, guys. This is a lot of fun.
Well, thanks so much to Jason for joining us this week. Great of him to take time out of his busy schedule to help us out on the show. We will definitely have him back in the future. And in the meantime, you can visit us on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. That's NICKDUKE. And then the rest of it. 87. And you can also join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Just go to your Facebook browser, search for Place to Be Nation Comics, join the club. We have lots of fun discussion there, lots of fun links as well to new comics content coming out. And, I mean, I have an Instagram account, but I don't use it. I don't think Nick uses his.
I'm not familiar with what an Instagram is.
Oh, you're very familiar with what an Instagram is, Nick. I know that for a fact.
Tails out of school.
Out of school. For work, but then I never used it, so they just wanted me to get one. So I don't know why. But anyway, it's there, technically. And our email addresses are not there, so don't email us. And you know what? Probably it was time.
Yeah, probably so.
Probably was time. Those email addresses have long ago gone the way of all things. But in any event, folks, we've got more great content coming your way in the month of September. What are some of the things we got coming their way, Nick?
So we have another installment of, what are we calling it, Greg? I forgot. I think we changed the name.
We changed the name to something else. That Fix It Show. That's what I'll call it for now.
About the bad comic book movies that we watch.
Fix It or Nix It. There we go.
We're going to do Fantastic Four, the Josh Trank 2015, I think it was. 15 sounds right. I think
that's correct.
Fantastic Four movie. We'll be doing an...
long book hunt on an unchosen Legion of Superheroes book,
which again I submit to you, Greg, is a no-win proposition, but we'll get there when we get there.
We're gonna get killed no matter what we do.
Doesn't matter if we like it, we didn't like it enough. If we don't like it, it's because we're terrible human beings. Like, it, there's just nothing we can do.
We're throwing them a bone though. Like, I'm gonna put it up to a vote on Twitter of what book we read for this, the Great Darkness Saga or the Geoff Johns Superman and the Superheroes. Because if it's Geoff Johns, there's a better than 50% chance that we'll like it.
Right.
Not 100%, but a better than 50% chance that we'll like it. But so we're going to put the poll. I'm going to put the poll out there on my Twitter account, gphillips8652.
Greg, give you a chance. Put his poll out there on Twitter.
I like to put my – wait just a minute. Will you stop? There's a primetime wrestling throwback for you. And we're going to let you guys choose which Legion of Superheroes book that we've never done that, by the way, for Long Book Hunters. We've never put it up to a poll.
No, because we don't really care about your opinions, generally.
No. And frankly, most of you don't have opinions about our show.
No, so most of you don't listen to it.
That's that notwithstanding, quite frankly, we are going to do that. And we'll have other stuff coming your way, too. Of course, we want to remind you that October is Walking Dead month.
Oh, boy.
Nick has never been less excited for Walking Dead month than he is this year. But
it'll be interesting to jump in for a season premiere
after not having watched the previous season.
Yeah, I'll be just go, oh, things are happening.
Who's that person? Who's that guy? How much does this fella weigh?
How much does this fella weigh?
And then in December,
why is everyone taking orders?
And then you'll probably find yourself asking what I did last year. Why didn't they kill off Rick four seasons ago? Anyway. And then, of course, in December, we're going to have a really intense month for us, the emotional farewell to Arrow. Mm-hmm. Hard-traveling fanboys bid farewell to our favorite DC comic with an entire month dedicated to Stephen Amell and company. So stay tuned to HTF. We got more stuff coming your way. Tune into all the other great shows here at Place to Be Nation. Nick, I just realized we've not done the live read yet.
Oh, we're not going to. We are Skip Giant Size special occasion.
That's right. Giant Size is a special occasion, and we hope that you enjoyed this special episode. Thanks again to Jason Ayers. We'll be back with another secret origin here in a few months. I think you guys will like that one, too. Meantime, keep cool, my baby!
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop Feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content, offering tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. all of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation pop listeners, this is your manager, Todd Weber, here to tell you all about the goings-on, PlaceToBeNation.com. Starting up with our Place to Be Nation pop podcast feed. Last week, the Hard Traveling Fanboys reviewed The Boys, Volume 1, by Garth Ennis and Derek Robertson in this edition of The Longbook Hunters. If you haven't checked out The Boys TV show on Amazon, you really should. It is something else. I loved it. On DC4U, our weekly look at DC Comics, Russell and myself conclude Justice League Month with the hilarious hijinks found in the network TV special from 1979, Legends of the Superheroes, The Roast. And then this week we talked about the bummer summer of DC Comics. Delays, people leaving projects, it's kind of a downer thing. But we did bring some optimism in with a look back at Justice League Unlimited. On the inaugural sports edition of Looking Forward, Looking Back, Andy Atherton is joined by the Cowboy Roger Morissette, Scott Criscolo, and Peter Winson to look forward and preview the upcoming NFL season, as well as look back and analyze the most recent seasons of the NBA and the NHL. The Year in Pop returns, with Andy and Scott being joined by George Ribellino, Dr. G, and J. Arsenio D'Amato. Look at all those good fellas to discuss the news, sports, and pop culture of 1977. On a brand new Sunday Groove, David and guest Andy Helene discuss their personal Desert Island discs. And the Marvel Age podcast is back. We cover 1972. We've got Werewolf by Night, Tomb of Dracula, Fantastic Four, lots of great reading, plus the Kree Skrull War. Facebook users, go to the PTVN's Greatest Song of the 80s Tournament. Like the page. We are continuing the Greatest Song of the 80s Tournament. There's four pulls a day. We're in round three. Never Gonna Give You Up is going strong. Sweet Child of Mine, probably gonna take it all, in my opinion. But like the page, vote every day. It is a ton of fun. Over on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we've got the PTBN Mothership, the Place to Be podcast. JT Scott and Peter Winston take a look at the last Saturday night's main event of 1989. Ben Zani has a football-themed episode of Row 1, Seat 1 with a pair of guests who discuss the New England Patriots and the Miami Dolphins. On the episode 3 of Extreme Three-Way Dance, JT, D'Amato, and Jenny run down the entire month of ECW Hardcore TV following the night the line was crossed from 1994. And on episode number 7 of You Don't Know Billy Jack, Drew introduces Jordan to Jumbo Saruta versus Gingikuchu Tenryu from June 5th, 1989. Lots of 1989. We're also paying tribute to 1994, 25 years. We've got lots of great content and articles, podcasts, lots of stuff talking about that great year in pop culture. Every Wednesday on Place to Be Nation, we've got the most interesting and unexpectedly funny stories on the World Wide Web on Glenn's Weekly Walk. Great collection of links for Wednesday reading. Check out our social media pages and message board at www.bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWWE pay-per-view and TV match ever project. Get in on the conversation today. Start researching your list. Those are due at the end of the year. We'll see what the best pay-per-view match is. I'm going with Steamboat Savage.
Thanks again for listening to the Hard Traveling Fanboys here on Place to Be Nation Bop.